Hello and welcome to today's webcast. My name is Krista and I'll be your event specialist today. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. And please note that today's webcast is being recorded. During the presentation, we will have a question and answer session. You can ask text questions at any time. Please submit your questions to gtsrprocurement@pge.com. If you would like to view the presentation in a full screen view, click the full screen button in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Press the escape key on your keyboard to return to your original view. For optimal viewing and participation, please disable your pop-up blockers. And finally, should you need technical assistance and as a best practice, we suggest you first refresh your browser. If that does not resolve the issue, please click on the support option in the upper right-hand corner of your screen for online troubleshooting. And it is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Izzy Carson. Izzy, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Krista. And thanks, everyone, for your patience as we work through the technical difficulties. My name is Izzy Carson, and I'm PG&E's procurement lead for the Regional Renewable Choice Program. And I want to welcome you to today's bidders webinar. To start, I just want to note that this program was formerly known as Enhanced Community Renewables, which is the regulatory name for the program. PG&E's brand name for the program, Regional Renewable Choice, or RRC, is how we will refer to the program throughout today's presentation. Besides myself, you'll also be hearing from my counterpart from our Customer Energy Solutions team, Dana Kofod, as we overview the program. Additionally, Diana Palayo will be talking us through the offer form and offer submittal process. Sandy Burns will discuss the offer evaluation methodology, and Doug Herman will be talking about the interconnection process. Once we finish the presentation, we'll have a break, and during that time, we'll collect all of the questions that are submitted to the RFO mailbox. Once we've gathered all of the questions, we'll have a Q&A session at the very end of the presentation. The purpose of this webinar is to give you information on this Regional Renewable Choice Request for Offers, which launched last Friday on August 24th. We will not be discussing any of the other procurement programs you see here, including the sister program to RRC, the Green Tariff Program, otherwise known as PG&E's Solar Choice. If you have any questions throughout the presentation, please send them to gtsrprocurement@pgne.com, and we'll collect them for the Q&A session at the end. The email address should be shown on the screen here. Depending on the level of questions, we may not get to all of the questions during the Q&A portion of the webinar, so a full transcript of the questions and answers will be posted to the Regional Renewable Choice website within a few days of this webinar. If we don't get to your question in the webinar, it will be included in the Q&A on the website. We will also be posting a list of all the attendees on our website. If you do not want your name or company published, please send an email to gtsrprocurement@pgne.com by the end of the day on Tuesday the 4th, next Tuesday. The slides and audio of this webinar will be posted to the website as well. This presentation is meant to be summary level only. We will not be getting into all the detailed information of the program, but we'll be presenting on the main highlights governing the solicitation and some of the unique components of the Regional Renewable Choice Program. To the extent that there are any conflicts between what's discussed during this presentation and the RFO materials, the RFO materials will govern. We highly encourage everyone to read the protocol and review the PPA documents prior to submitting an offer. If you have any questions on any of the solicitation documents, we encourage you to reach out to us and get clarification before you submit an offer. Some information received in the solicitation is required to be submitted to the CPUC, and some information is made public as part of the CPUC's renewable auction mechanism decision. By participating in this solicitation, you are giving PG&E authorization to disclose the bulleted items that you see here. Now that we've set the stage for this webinar, let's do an overview of the program. Now I hand it to Dana to discuss some program-specific requirements.
Thank you, Izzy. The Regional Renewable Choice Program is under the umbrella of Green Tariff Shared Renewables, or GTSR programs, which is comprised of two related but distinct programs. The main difference between the two programs is that Regional Renewable Choice is a developer-driven program, in which developers are directly seeking customers to enroll in a portion of the output of a specific project they are developing. Slide 9 takes another look at the GTSR program as a whole. There are 600 megawatts allocated to GTSR, and PG&E's portion of that total is 272 megawatts. There is no further allocation or bifurcation of PG&E's 272 megawatts between the Green Tariff, or Solar Choice, and the RRC program. Note that almost 55 megawatts have already been procured under PG&E's Solar Choice program toward the 272 cap. The remaining capacity for both programs is approximately 272 megawatts. Of the 272, 45 megawatts have been reserved for environmental justice, and 45 are allocated to residential enrollment. This slide takes a closer look at the structure of the Regional Renewable Choice Program. You can see that there are transactions between three parties: developers, customers, and PG&E. In the right corner of the slide, you'll see that PG&E has a power purchase agreement with the developer, as we would in our other procurement programs. The main difference here is that developers are seeking enrollments and revenues directly from customers, and the utility only pays the developer under limited circumstances in the PPA for what's called unsubscribed energy. I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation. Developers then have a transaction with individual customers. On the right-hand side, or on the left-hand side, there you'll see the customer-developer agreement. In this transaction, a customer is subscribing to a portion of the project and paying the developer directly for their subscription. PG&E is not a party to this agreement, and we will not know the financial agreement between the developer and customer. Finally, PG&E will be providing a separate energy statement to each enrolled customer, which is a credit based on the calendar month output of the customer's subscription level to the project. Note that this is a separate statement from the billing transaction that occurs between the customer and the developer. The first programmatic specific requirement to discuss is the GreenE compliance aspect of the program. Under Senate Bill 43, the Regional Renewable Choice Program is required to be GreenE certified as administered by the Center for Resource Solutions. The program, as driven by the renewable energy project developer, takes on the responsibility for marketing the project directly to the customers, and as such, they are agreeing to comply with the GreenE Energy Environmental and Customer Protection Standards. GreenE Energy compliance requirements include guidelines on all product marketing and an obligation to provide end-user customers with accurate and sufficient disclosures regarding the project. More information can be found on the GreenE website in a document that's called the California Enhanced Community Renewables Information for Developers and Generators. This document goes into greater detail on the specific requirements from GreenE. Next, we will be discussing the marketing review process. This is related to the GreenE energy compliance with some additional elements. The CPUC's final decision on the GTSR program states that PG&E must review developer marketing materials before they are used to market to customers. As such, developer marketing materials must comply with the GreenE Energy developer requirements mentioned on the last slide. Developer marketing materials must comply with GreenE developer requirements, the California Public Utility Commission Community Choice Aggregation Code of Conduct, which includes marketing and outreach requirements relative to community choice aggregation, must be truthful, accurate, and not false or misleading, and PG&E disclaimer and logo usage guidelines. Developer marketing material submissions will be made to PG&E and must include all materials a developer intends to use for phase one of community interest of marketing to customers, or phase two, the enrollment phase. There's more detail about this distinction between the two phases and the guidelines. At a high level, phase one is a customer expressing interest in the program, and phase two is a customer committing to enroll in a transaction. The second item that a developer must include in their submission is the marketing compliance attestation, and the third is a summary of all claims and factual statements made in the marketing materials. Submissions can be made to solarchoicemarketing@pg&e.com. For further context to the last slide, the materials will be forwarded to a Greeny liaison as they do the first review, and they may directly interact with the developers as well as part of the compliance requirements. Moving forward with the community interest requirements entails that a developer must provide documentation that community members have done one of two things: either committed to enroll in 30% of the project's capacity, or provided expressions of interest in the project sufficient to reach 51% of the project's capacity. The distinction between committing to enroll and providing expression of interest is detailed on the bottom of the slide. But there are additional disclosures that a developer must take for the commitment to enroll for the 30% of the project's capacity. The second element of the community interest requirement is that the demonstration of interest must be at least 50% and 1/6 of the community interest has to come from residential subscribers detailed in point number two. The third element is that the demonstration from the project side from 3 megawatts to 20 megawatts have to have a minimum number of required subscribers, which should increase as the project size increases by at least one customer for each additional megawatt of project capacity. For example, 3 subscribers for 3 megawatt projects, but 20 subscribers for 20 megawatt projects. Note that municipalities or counties may provide a guaranteed subscription rate to demonstrate community interest. For the purpose of community interest, the community members and subscribers must be located within the same municipality, county, or 10 miles of the project's address, and they must meet the eligibility requirements as defined in our tariff, the EECR tariff. For the program's final CPUC decision, PG&E is seeking a total of 45 megawatts of environmental justice projects and has a preference for projects located in designated EJ areas in the solicitation process. Environmental justice areas were determined using the Cal EnviroScreen tool, and PG&E has posted a list of eligible EJ census tracts on its website. EJ projects will compete in their own bucket for this solicitation and will be evaluated separately from other offers. Note that to participate in the RFO, projects must be located in an eligible census tract and be sized between 0.5 and 1 megawatt. The securities opinion. The decision in 2017 modified the original 2015 decision to replace the requirement to obtain a securities opinion from an Am Law 100 firm. The language here is what was replaced. The lawyer primarily responsible for the issuance of the opinion has, within the last 8 years, practiced federal and California securities law as a significant portion of their practice, meaning at least 5 full-time years. And such experience included registering or qualifying offering or sales of securities, effecting private placements of securities, and or advising issuers or sellers of securities with respect to exemptions from qualification and registration requirements. The second is that the lawyer is primarily responsible for issuance of the opinion, is licensed to practice law in California, and the lawyer's license is active and not under suspension. Lastly, there must be a minimum of $10 million in professional liability insurance coverage that includes coverage for security practice. The unique structure of the power purchase payments is the last program-specific requirement to discuss. Because the intent of the program is for developers to obtain revenues directly from customers, the payment structure in the contract between PG&E and the developer has been modified to reflect the circumstances in which PG&E pays the developer under the PPA. If the developer is unable to obtain customer subscriptions for any portion of the project's output in a given month, PG&E pays for what is referred to as unsubscribed energy. But the price at which PG&E pays for unsubscribed energy is dependent upon the project's customer subscription level in any given month. The price at which PG&E pays for unsubscribed energy depends on the contract year and if the developer has met the minimum subscription requirement designated for that contract year. If the developer has met the minimum subscription requirement, the developer is paid the PPA price bid into the solicitation for any unsubscribed energy. If they do not meet the minimum subscription requirement, then the developer is paid for the lesser of the RRC contract price or a market value of energy, known as the default load aggregation point, or DLAP, plus a $10 REC value. Let's take a look at a few examples to see how this works. The minimum subscription requirement in the first year contract in any month is 45%. Let's say a project is only 40% subscribed in March for the first contract year. PG&E pays for all unsubscribed energy for the month, in this case, 60% of the project's output. But at what price? Since the developer did not meet the minimum subscription requirement of 45%, the payment will be the lesser of the RRC contract price or the DLAP plus a REC value. In the second example, let's say a couple of months go by and the project is now 60% subscribed during the month of May for the first contract year. The project exceeded the minimum subscription level during the month of May, but that means it still has 40% of the project unsubscribed. Since the project exceeded the 45% minimum subscription threshold, the payment for the remaining 40% of unsubscribed energy is at the RRC contract price. Finally, in the third example, the project is 100% subscribed by customers in June of the first contract year, which means that there is no payment from PG&E to the developer. Lastly, we wanted to include other resources as an opportunity. The California Department of Community Services and Development, CSD for short, is offering incentives for community solar projects that help increase clean energy access and reduce energy costs for low-income households. CSD anticipates making two or more community solar pilot awards to projects, and they have allocated up to $5 million of incentive funds available with a cap of $3 million per project. Any project submitted for PG&E's Regional Renewable Choice Program is eligible to apply for the CSD opportunity. Developers interested in learning more about this incentive opportunity, including the requirements, considerations, and how to apply, please visit the website that we've linked here on these slides. So now that we've done an overview of the program, let's look more closely at the solicitation. Now I'll hand it over to Izzy to discuss the solicitation overview.
Thanks, Dana. Let's take a little closer look at the solicitation.
PG&E has 197.59 megawatts of a procurement target for this solicitation. There are two buckets that projects will fall into. One is for EJ-eligible projects, and another bucket for otherwise eligible RRC projects, each with three project categories within the bucket: as available peaking, as available non-peaking, and baseload. The product categories align with the delivery profile of the generating resource, so please see the PPA for further information, and PG&E will not be accepting any offers with storage at this time. Looking at the RFO schedule, you'll see that the solicitation launched on August 24th, and we're currently holding the webinar. Offers will be due by 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on September 18th. PG&E will be notifying selected and waitlisted participants of their status by October 30th, which will then trigger the 60-day demonstration of community interest requirement. On November 6th, participants that wish to continue will need to submit signed PPAs and required documentation through Power Advocate. Participants will need to complete the demonstration of community interest requirement and submit the securities opinion by December 31st. After PG&E verifies demonstration of community interest documentation, the target execution of contracts is January 31st, and the target advice letter filing for approval of contracts will be a month after that. I want to highlight for you that we have an independent evaluator that will be monitoring all of the activity in this RFO. The IE is tasked with monitoring the evaluation process and ensuring that we use the methodology that's described in the solicitation protocol. It's the IE's responsibility to report on the process and propose transactions to the CPC when we file PPAs for CPC approval. The independent evaluator may review all offer data in addition to communication with participants. The independent evaluator is Arroyo Seco Consulting, and the contact information for Lewis Hashimoto is located on this slide. Looking at eligibility criteria, projects can be any RPS-eligible technology sized half to 20 megawatts located in PG&E service territory and connected to PG&E's distribution or transmission system. To be eligible to bid, the project must be a new generating facility and either have an executed interconnection agreement or have a Phase 2 interconnection study or equivalent. The project can be energy-only or have partial or full capacity deliverability status, and have 36 months to achieve commercial operation with a 6-month permitted extension. Sellers can also elect a 10, 15, or 20-year contract term. Transactions can only be full buy or sell only. Excess sale arrangements are not permitted under this program. Note that to qualify under the baseload product category in either the main or the EJ bucket, the project must have at least 80% capacity factor with respect to the contract capacity. Continuing with eligibility, projects that have received CSI or SGIP incentives are not eligible to participate. At least one member of the development team must have completed or begun construction on a project of similar technology and capacity. The project must employ technology that's currently in use, and the participant must demonstrate that it has 100% site control of the project at the time of offer submittal. PG&E is also requiring that participants have completed the marketing material review process at the time of offer submittal to ensure that developers are ready to market when the clock for the demonstration of community interest starts. As mentioned, demonstration of community interest must be met within 60 days of the notification date, and securities opinion stating that the arrangement complies with securities law must also be met within 60 days of the notification date. With regards to deliverability, PG&E does not require, nor does it have a stated preference for deliverability. Projects may bid in as energy only, partial deliverability, or full capacity deliverability. If a project does bid in as partial or fully deliverable, it must meet the deliverability date that you put on the offer form or face penalties or default under the PPA. Projects bidding in as fully or partially deliverable must provide documentation that the project has received FCDS or PCDS, or is in Phase 2 process of deliverability study at offer submittal. Please review these provisions in the PPA if you're considering a bid as a deliverability project. Note that an application for CAISO's annual deliverability assessment does not qualify unless the project has a deliverability finding at the time of offer submittal on September 18th. Now we'll turn to power purchase agreement and look at some regional renewable choice specific language and also go over some standard RAM PPA terms. So the contract for the RSC program uses two documents. The first is the unmodified form RAM 6 PPA, which is the underlying contract. And the second is the RRC rider that works with the RAM PPA and acts like an amendment to the underlying RAM PPA. The terms in the RRC rider modify the terms in the RAM PPA. When we refer to the RRC PPA, we are referring to both documents that work together. The terms and conditions of both documents have been approved by the CPC and are non-negotiable. And again, what I'm about to review is summary level and should not replace reviewing both the RAM PPA and the RRC rider. I will highlight some of the key provisions in the RRC rider. Next. So some of the terms in the rider include language about the developer's obligations with Greenie, which we discussed earlier. Additionally, the rider includes representations, warranties, and indemnities that relate to the seller's transaction with customers. But again, PG&E is not a party to that agreement. Some examples of this include customer subscription levels, Greenie energy requirements, marketing, contents of the customer developer agreement, and prohibition against selling subscriptions exceeding 100% of the project capacity. The rider also includes customer protections such as buyer beware and customer complaint provisions pursuant to Decision 1501051. As we discussed earlier, a legal opinion is still a requirement prior to execution of a PPA, and the securities opinion must state that the project complies with securities law and that the IOU and its ratepayers are not at risk for securities claims associated with the project. Also outlined in the rider is the seller's election of the transaction type. Only full buy-sale arrangements are allowed due to the variability of generation under excess sale agreements, which serve on-site load before delivering to the grid. The performance assurance and damage payment provisions have been updated in the RRC rider. In the underlying RAM PPA, these provisions were formally based off of calculating expected revenues. And since revenues come directly from customers in the RRC program, these provisions were modified to be the fixed value calculations you see on the slide. Projects have 36 months from the time of CPC approval to achieve commercial operation with a 6-month permanent extension. The last thing I want to point out in the rider is the time of delivery factors, which are consistent with the approved TOD factors provided in the 2017 RPS plan. Continue reviewing some of the standard PPA terms and conditions. The seller must deliver all product to PG&E, which is all of the energy produced by the facility, plus all of the renewable attributes associated with the facility. As mentioned, commercial operation must occur within 36 months, and any failure to meet the guaranteed commercial operation date after permanent extensions is an event of default, which allows PG&E to terminate the PPA and collect any related damages. The seller must agree to a minimum quantity for the guaranteed energy production, or GEP, from the project. Failure to meet the GEP may result in damages or an event of default. Sellers are required to have systems in place to respond to electronic signals to curtail energy. Finally, sellers must curtail energy deliveries in response to curtailment orders from the CAISO or PG&E, and we encourage you to review the curtailment section of the PPA to understand what circumstances the seller will or will not be paid for curtailment orders subject to subscription levels. Now I'll hand it over to Sandy to walk through the evaluation methodology for the RFO.
So I'm going to describe the evaluation methodology we use when your offers come in. And the first thing we do is screen the offers and make sure they meet our eligibility criteria. And that would include reviewing whether you're offering an eligible renewable product or that you're connecting to the system in PG&E service territory or that you have the appropriate interconnection studies or equivalent. And once we've screened out anything that's non-compliant, we apply our least cost best fit methodology. And this methodology is the same methodology that we use for all our renewable procurement RFOs. So if you've participated in those or been on a webinar, this methodology will look very familiar. and there's nothing new here. In fact, this methodology was documented in our 2014 RPS RFO, and it hasn't changed since then. And it's basically a cost-benefit methodology. And we use this as a means of ranking projects. So the absolute value of the net market value is less important than the relative value of the offers to each other when we rank them. So we start with a calculation called net market value, which I'll describe on the next slide. And that methodology is similar for all three utilities, and it has the same components as defined by the PC. And then in some cases, we make adjustments to the net market value to account for some specific characteristics and preferences for PG&E's portfolio, and that's what we refer to as portfolio adjusted value, or PAV. And the PAV adjustment has no impact on our overall result in this RFO because most of the offers are similar with respect to key elements such as location and curtailment provisions. So in the interest of not burdening you with unnecessary information, I'm going to focus on net market value today. So the next slide shows the formula for net market value. And it's a formula that's been adopted by the CPUC, and it looks at the costs and benefits of your offer in the context of how it compares to other products that can be purchased on the market. So the benefit is the first part of the equation, which is the positive numbers, and the costs are the remainder, which is the part that's getting subtracted out. So the benefit comes from avoiding the purchase of a comparable product from the market. And the energy benefit is the avoided cost of purchasing energy, and it reflects our forecast of location-specific energy prices, and those account for congestion and losses. It also considers the fact that energy prices can go negative, and we might be paying for curtailment when prices go negative. The capacity value is the value of the RA that we get from your project. And if your project is fully deliverable or partially deliverable and you're providing RA, then that's less RA that we need to procure from the market. And there's more on that on the slide to come, which is not yet. Ancillary services are only associated with resources that are fully dispatchable and not for intermittent resources, so that value is zero for renewables. And then on the cost side, the cost includes a PPA price that is paid under the contract, plus costs that are incurred by ratepayers that are attributable to your offer, even if they're not part of the contract price. And those costs are the transmission network upgrades and integration. So the transmission costs, which is the T in the equation, are identified in your interconnection study. So the reimbursable network upgrades that are ultimately paid by our customers, so we include them as a cost of your offer. And the I, or the integration cost, is applied to intermittent resources such as wind and solar, and it reflects the cost of additional flexible capacity that must be added to the system to accommodate the intermittent resource. And the amount of flexible capacity that must be added to accommodate an incremental megawatt of wind or solar has been determined by the CAISO. Okay, so the next slide. The next slide provides a little more detail on how we treat capacity value and transmission network upgrades. And to be clear, as Izzy said, there's no specific requirement to provide RA and be deliverable. And we don't have a specific preference for whether you're fully deliverable or partially deliverable. It's all about the costs and the benefits. So on the cost side, we look at the reimbursable costs from your interconnection study. And since those costs ultimately go into customer rates, we add them to your bid price. And for energy-only resources, we just look at the reliability network upgrades. And for deliverable resources, we look at the reliability network upgrades plus the delivery network upgrades. And then on the benefit side, we start calculating capacity value in the year that you commit to being fully deliverable or partially deliverable. And we calculate the RA value by looking at the net qualifying capacity, or NQC, of your resource and multiply that by the cost of purchasing the capacity on the market in that year. So NQC measures how much RA value your resource can qualify for. And the methodology we use to estimate that amount. It's called Equivalent Load Carrying Capability, or ELCC. And the net qualifying capacity of a wind or solar resource is much less than 100% of your resource nameplate capacity. Since the equivalent part of the ELCC name refers to the equivalence relative to a perfect megawatt of capacity. And then the other part of the equation is the cost of the RA megawatt we would purchase if your resource wasn't there. And so when our portfolio was long on RA, like it is now, and RA prices are low, the capacity value calculates out as low. So to reiterate, you know, while the value of a fully deliverable resource might be somewhat higher than an energy-only resource, the cost might be higher too due to the network upgrade. So that's why we don't have a specific preference for one or the other. Okay, so that's our least cost best fit methodology in a nutshell. Again, there's nothing new here. It's consistent with all our previous renewable RFOs. So now I'll turn it back to Diana, who will talk about the mechanics of submitting your offer.
Thank you, Sandy. For offers, they must be submitted via the online platform at the Power Advocate site. Registration is required in order to submit an offer. You can register through the Power Advocate site at the link displayed on the screen, which is also posted on PG&E's Regional Renewable Choice website. The offer submittal deadline is 1 p.m. on Tuesday, September 18th. Power Advocate will not accept offers beyond this 1 p.m. deadline. PG&E strongly encourages you to register well in advance of the offer due date and will only consider offers that, as of the submittal deadline, are complete and conforming offers. If submitted offer documents are found to be incomplete or have errors, PG&E will notify participants via email and allow 2 business days to correct. By submitting an offer into this RFO, each participant is required to abide by the confidentiality obligations specified in the protocol. The following are some keys to a successful proposal. Sellers may choose to bid a single project with up to 4 variations. Variations include size, delivery term, fixed price versus escalating price, and full or partial capacity deliverability status versus energy only. Be sure to submit a competitively priced offer, as price refreshes are not allowed. Also, be sure to submit a complete offer, including your most recent interconnection study or agreement as applicable. The Regional Renewable Choice Protocol outlines the documents required as part of the offer package and specifies the format for each. Required documents for offer submission are listed here and include the offer form, PPA cover sheet and appendix, site control questionnaire and attestation, acknowledgement and commitment of site owner, if applicable, interconnection studies, and single line diagram. Please confirm that your documents are in the specified Excel, PDF, or Word format prior to submitting your offer package. The RFO website for the Regional Renewable Choice Solicitation provides all necessary documents and instructions to submit an offer into the solicitation. Please take a moment to note these 2 emails on the screen. All communication should be directed to gtsrprocurement@pge.com. And please be sure to copy the independent evaluator at arroyosecoconsulting@gmail.com on any correspondence. A copy of these slides will be posted to our website as well. And now we'll go over the offer form structure. The offer form is structured with the following tabs. We will go through the majority of these in subsequent slides. Please note that the tabs displayed at the bottom of the screen are shown as they appear on the offer form. Okay, we'll start first with the instructions tab. We want to emphasize the importance of enabling macros before you start. Many of the cells within the offer form are linked and will display an error message or will lock the cell entirely if macros are not enabled. Again, please be sure to enable macros when opening the form before any entries are made. Please save and submit the form in Microsoft Excel binary .xlsb format. Each cell with a yellow background must be filled out in the form. Once completed, the yellow background will disappear. Once all the yellow fields have been completed, the word complete will show at the top of each page. Prior to submitting your offer form, please be sure to double check to ensure the word complete appears at the top of each page. There is also a validation tab that will show the status of each page and whether the offer form in its entirety is complete. Please include at least one authorized contact in the developer information section. Note that the contact listed will be copied in email communication with PG&E. In the counterparty section of this tab, the legal entity entered should be the legal name that would be signing the PPA if the project were to be selected. The tab also requires evidence that one member of the development team has completed at least one similar project of similar technology and capacity, or has begun construction of at least one similar project. The Developer Experience tab also includes several attestations and affirmations specific to this RFO. Please be sure to read through each of these. These include agreeing that no substantive changes will be made to the marketing plans or materials reviewed by PG&E, agreeing that the participant has read the code of conduct and will not circumvent it, agreeing that the participant has received, read, and meets the green energy requirements, and acknowledging that the participant will have to comply with the demonstration of community interest and security options requirements if awarded. The Product Description tab will allow you to detail the specifics of your project. Please note that the number of inputs required is listed on the top of the page, circled here for reference at the top. As the required yellow cells are completed, the number of missing inputs listed at the top of the screen will go down. Once every cell has been completed, this section will show complete. A couple of fields that we want to highlight on the Product Description tab are shown here. If partial or full capacity deliverability are selected, be sure to fill in the deliverability date based on your interconnection documentation. Additionally, the average pre-TOD price shown here as grayed out will be automatically populated after a calculator is run on the Generation Profile tab. And be sure to fill in the interconnection details in the required electrical interconnection section. On the Energy Pricing tab, select either fixed or escalating for the pricing type. Fixed pricing requires inputting only the first year price, while escalated pricing requires first year and annual escalation rates. Note that the grayed out cells will be automatically populated after the calculator is run on the Generation Profile tab. This tab asks that the participant to provide a generation profile forecast for the project's average day net output energy generation production, stated in megawatts by hour, by month, and by year. Once you have entered a generation profile, hit the green Calculate button. This will populate dependent fields in other tabs. And last is the File Name tab, which is a new addition to the offer form. Please carefully follow the instructions on this tab to create a unique file name for each offer form file to be submitted. The file name should be generated after you have finalized the rest of the form and just prior to actual submission. And now I'll go ahead and hand it over to Doug for interconnection.
Okay, go to the next slide, please. Just to give a little overview of the interconnection, there are three tariffs governing connection to PG&E's grid. Rule 21, PG&E's wholesale distribution tariff, and then CalISO tariff. Rule 21 is not applicable for this RFO, as was mentioned in the protocol. And the wholesale distribution tariff is applicable for projects connecting to lines under 60 kV, and then the CAISO tariff would be applicable for connections to lines at 60 kV or above. And then within these tariffs, there are three different study processes, and pretty much the same for PG&E or CAISO tariffs. Fast track, independent study, and cluster. As mentioned previously regarding the RFO requirements for interconnection, we're requiring a phase two or equivalent study at the time you submit your offer. And as far as deliverability, we don't have any preference there, either energy only, partial capacity, or full capacity. The next slide just summarizes some of the key steps and timelines for the three different study processes, and also highlights kind of what we consider to be equivalent to the phase two study in terms of where you need to be at the time of submitting an offer. So, for example, in the fast track process, which is designed really for energy-only interconnections, there are four key steps, and you have to go through all of them, get through the supplemental review step to be equivalent to the phase two. For the independent study, there are about six key steps, and you have to get through the facility study step to be equivalent to the phase two. And then for the cluster process, which is a lot longer, sort of roughly 2 1/3 years to get through the whole process, you have to get through the phase two study, which occurs in the second year of the process, towards the end of that second year. And that phase two study would have the network upgrade estimates that we would use to evaluate the cost of network upgrades and evaluating your bids. So anyway, you can see the relative timeline for the three different study processes here. The fast track can get approximately through 10 weeks for an energy-only project. Independent study, roughly eight months. And then as I mentioned, like two and a third years to get through for full capacity deliverability in the cluster process, or about 1 2/3 years for an energy-only project. And then I just have some additional comments there on some of the qualifications required to go through the fast track or the independent study. I won't go through the details there. I think they're pretty self-explanatory. Okay, so that summarizes the interconnection. Hand it back to Izzy.
All right, so that's the end of our presentation. We'll take a quick intermission here, about 5 minutes or so, to run through some of the questions that have come into the GTSR procurement at pg&e.com mailbox. If you have any additional questions, please email them now. When we return and shortly, we'll go through those questions and answers.
At this time, we will take a short intermission to review the questions submitted via email. If you would like to submit a question, please email gtsrprocurement@pge.com. You will hear music during this intermission. Thank you, and please stand by. Thank you.
We've got a couple of questions that came into the email box throughout the presentation, so we'll try to answer those best we can here. And again, we'll post the answers and the questions to the website within the next few days. So the first question is, do Phase 1 market materials have to be approved prior to the close of auction? Is submittal of materials for review prior to auction close sufficient? So as mentioned in the webinar, marketing materials need to be submitted and approved prior to offer submittal. So the offer submittal date is September 18th, which is a couple weeks out. So yes, they have to be approved prior to the offer submittal date. The next question is, SCE requires 5% of power sold to the utility. Is this true for PG&E? No, there's the cap as mentioned, the prohibition against selling subscriptions that exceed 100% of the project capacity, but there's no minimum requirement. The third question is, why does it take 2 months from PPA execution to filing for CPC approval, and how long after filing is CPC approval expected? So the schedule outlines actually only 1 month between the target time frame execution for final agreements. We have in there January 31st, and the target advice letter filing date is March 1st, really because February is a short month, but it really is only 1 month is the target between execution and filing. How long is filing how long after filing is CPC approval expected? The minimum would be 30 days, but if the CPC needs more time, it definitely can be extended beyond that.
So the next question pertains to the community interest phase. So the question is, PG&E's expression of interest form asks for account and meter info. Practically all customers do not have this information. And a mention about SCE approving community interest without the required account information for customers. The question is, does PG&E require account information for expression of interest? Depending on the size of the project, the expression of interest could amount to thousands. So the information related to the expression of interest and commitment to enroll forms is on our website. We do require account information, but with that said, we especially require the service agreement ID, and the reason for that is the enrollment is at the service agreement level. So the service agreement level is absolutely required. The account information we would prefer, but we can work with the customers or the developers. For instance, we could help with residential customers to help to identify where that information may be found on their bill. And for commercial customers, we can engage our account reps to help work with the customer to obtain that information as well.
Okay, the next question is, can the PPA rate with the customers differ from the offer rate submitted to PG&E in this offer? And absolutely. Again, PG&E is not a party to the agreement between the customer and the developer, so you're welcome to have any arrangement. It does not need to match the offer submitted into the PPA, or the PPA rate that's submitted into the offer form. And the last question is that SCE requires all projects to be submitted with a 10-year offer. Does PG&E also require a 10-year offer? No, a 10 or a 15 or a 20-year offer is available in this RFO, but there's no requirement for a 10. And those are all the questions that have come into the box. If there are any additional questions, please feel free to email the GTSR procurement at PG&E box, and we'll post those on the website as well. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you to all of our participants for joining us today. We hope you found this webcast presentation informative. This concludes our webcast. You may now disconnect and have a great day.